I just came off a two-week retreat a few days ago. It's, of course, interesting how time changes, how it, the perception of it is can be different at different times of our lives. So, the retreat tended to feel like it was lasting a long time. And then these last few days, they've also felt like a long period of time, but it's only been 3 days versus 2 weeks. So I quite enjoy solitude and being alone, contrary to my natural tendencies. But I found on this retreat it was quite helpful. I think almost every year I usually fast, and for many years I did a juice fast, and then the last couple of years I've just used water. And I told Ajñānaka that I thought, oh, maybe I won't fast this year. And I felt a little defeated by it. And he said, oh, good, you can be normal. Interestingly enough, eating food for this two-week period was quite different. And one of the things I noticed, not so much about food, was just the sense of really unplugging from the more active life that I've grown accustomed to in the monastery. And what I found was interesting, especially more so this time, was just I'd been working a lot, especially on certain projects, spending a fair amount of time on the computer, and I just noticed the difference of clinging and becoming energy that changed as soon as I switched focus and put down the responsibilities and just stayed in my kuti. And what I noticed most was the sense when I started the retreat of this slow release from that clinging, whereas it was felt just in the days prior to going on retreat, just I have to get this done, or I should do this, or I need to spend this time in the afternoon, none of which was really true, but it felt that way. And the strange aspect of it is how a longer period of solitude helps remove that clinging sometimes right away. It's just very easy to, during longer periods alone, I find for myself, to let go of those objects of clinging and thinking that we need to live our lives the way we are particularly living them, just going through the same customs and actions and behaviors every day, because that's just what we do. So the retreat was quite valuable, as I find all of them are, actually, in just reminding me, oh, it's a different way of being, and it's not necessarily the case that when we're active and when we're, especially in the monastery around others, we have to kind of take up that becoming energy and that clinging to what it is that we think we should do and how we should do it and when and where. And it wasn't like I wasn't suffering anymore. So, of course, the mind, it'll just keep taking up suffering in one way or another. But yet this tension around activity and busyness and being active can drop away. And then the question for me that arose is, oh, what? And that has often arisen over the years as a monk is, where did that go? Where did that clinging, where did that sense of need to be doing go? And especially as I find that spending a lot of time, especially behind a computer or doing projects and not inclining as much to the formal practice, one can feel this in the mind very strongly. And so the question that's asked is kind of like, well, why is that? Why is that so hard to see when we're engaged in these kind of activities? And I think the solution or the answer to that is quite obvious. We're just not giving ourselves enough solitude. We're not giving ourselves some quiet. We're not giving ourselves some stepping away. And so it can appear that this is just the new normal, or the way it should be. And so I think as a monk, one of the things I've learned is just to try to be very careful. And I still, sometimes I succeed, but a lot of times there can be a lot of failure in that. Being careful around how it is that I spend my time, what are the activities I engage in. And this doesn't mean that as monks, nuns, or any lay practitioners, it's all the same. I think it's like, what do we lend our minds to? It's not necessarily just being active is the quality that we want to disengage from. It's how we're active and who we're active with and what it is that we're doing that we need to be careful with. So somebody in the community might want to make a robe for another person or for themselves, or dye a robe or learn a new skill or work in the workshop or something like that. And that's not necessarily a task that is pulling oneself away from solitude. Solitude can be, it's of course a state of mind. If we can have solitude around others, that's also possible, but it's not easy to do that. I think it takes a long time to develop states of mind where we feel a very strong sense of solitude that we can maintain when we're around others. Because just speaking for myself, there's a lot of feeling activated and energized and moved when I'm around other people, or even absorbed in thinking about other people or reading a book or something like that, where it's just like impingement from another person or the thoughts of another person. So I think it's important to remind ourselves that we want to spend time each day, no matter what we do in our lives, finding some kind of solitude where we're not engaged. And for most of us, that's just an obvious given. We have the whole afternoon, for the most part, to spend time alone. And there is a sense of a recognition that we can have daily, not just on retreat, of that clinging to activity or that becoming around activity is falling away, or the self-referential behavior that we can engage in around others, where we can sometimes define ourselves based on how others are reacting to us. One of the reflections I gave a couple of weeks ago was about this particular once a week morning tea or breakfast time that we have called bread breakfast. And it's a great place for practice, because whatever you do, whether you avoid it altogether or you attend it in some way, it usually, at least for myself, and I am making certain assumptions about others, that it sort of, it lights up certain buttons and activations. And even the notion of like just trying to keep one's eyes down and not look at what another monk or another person has on their plate. You're like, well, how are they doing it? Or what are they doing? And, oh, that's so much. Oh, they're so restrained, they didn't even have any. Or he's just soaking his bread in hot water. That's a true ascetic. I could never do that. All these ways, they're ways that we're objectifying ourselves through our own minds. It doesn't even have to be through an actual person judging us or thinking of us in a particular way. We're just referring to another person and thinking of ourselves as an object in their own eyes. That can happen. And so it's not that there's something wrong with that, it's just that we have to be really careful about how it is when we're around others and how we're interacting and what it is that we're doing with our minds. And so we can actually use those times, which is how Ajahn Chah had set up his monasteries from the very beginning, was to use the times that we have contact with others, for an opportunity to observe our minds, but not to exclusively just have that be the activity that we're doing. So we want to be going kind of in and out of connection, in and out of socializing to a certain degree, because I think it is very rare for individuals who can just be in solitude all the time and gain from that. There are people who can do that. We read of certain Buddhist masters who spent decades just practicing in a cave, and I think that's possible, but I also think it's for a very rare person. The likelihood of many people being able to succeed in that, I think it has a low likelihood, it has not much of a possibility. Because even though we can be activated around others, we also are using contact with others as a point of reference. So it's just how we're picking up the skill of what we're doing. And so whether we're in solitude or, you know, we're alone with our thoughts or our moods, we're focusing the mind, concentrating the mind, it can be quite beneficial. But without that contact with others, then we can actually lose the reference points that we have. Oh, this is actually where my mind is going with this particular activation, this interaction. So I think for myself, and I would guess for many practitioners here, just as a reflection, how helpful it's been to continue to go in and out of that, interacting with others in solitude again. And of course, when we are alone, that's not to say that it can't be quite difficult. You know, it's not to say that when we're quiet and by ourselves, whether we're sitting in meditation, walking, or we're just doing an activity alone, that our minds drift off. And where do they often go to? They go into our stories of me and mine and our past, our future, the remorse we have for such an event or saying this to that person, or I shouldn't have said that. And so it's helpful, but then you're with people again. You know, your thoughts are again with people. And it's true that those can be what a lot of our stories are about. While I was on retreat, an interesting thing I learned about, as I understand it, a group of psychologists were studying brain activity and asking a question around what areas of the brain are active during socialization. And so they found that, but there wasn't anything that was very interesting about it until one of the scientists asked, well, what is it that your brain is doing when you're not doing anything? And what they concluded through multiple studies of many people was that the areas in our brain that are lighting up when we're not doing anything are the same areas of the brain that are lighting up when we're socializing, when we're around other people, when we're interacting. So we seem to be bent in a almost evolutionary way towards thinking about others. And luckily the Buddha, he said, well, right, that's not necessarily the way that we want to allow our minds to move, though. So we can say that I think the naturalistic fallacy goes that whatever is natural is normal, and whatever is normal is good. But it's a fallacy because it's not necessarily correct. So even though we might be thinking about others, I think that's just another point of contact. And it can remove that sense of solitude. So the Buddha didn't say, well, this is what meditation is. This is how you realize enlightenment. Just think about other people all the time. He was encouraging us to really look at desire and to understand how desire was causing us dukkha. And I find it interesting because, like, on retreat, when I'm at least, you know, focusing my mind, letting my mind to breath meditation or listening to the nada sound, I find over and over again the insight that keeps coming up is just how there is dukkha. It is present. This is what the mind keeps coming back to. It's like, oh, right, there's some dissatisfaction here. And why that's such a fundamental insight is because I believe most of us fight against it. And that's the third area, the fourth area, the kind of sense, you know, this is uncomfortable, or I don't like this, but I don't want to be like this, or I don't want to have this experience. I don't want to suffer. So the Buddha was saying, well, of course, that's right. That's the whole point. There is suffering. There's no way around it. And it's so basic that it doesn't really seem like it would be a noble truth until we see how often we are fighting against it. I shouldn't suffer. It shouldn't be this way. And so the release of that dukkha really comes from, a part of where it comes from is really this insider in terms of that first noble truth. And the Buddha says that it should be understood. And the depth of that understanding, it's not shallow. It's not something that's easy to comprehend. It hasn't been in my experience because it's so easy to forget, to be tricked by, to be fooled by. I'm not sure if everyone finds that in their own mind, but for myself, it's just over and over again, there's some sort of struggle, something happening, and then there's, oh, right, yeah, this is discontent, this is stress. That's all it is. It's nothing more than that. And then the mind can pick up the exact same thing just a moment later. right back, same story. So, you know, there's a letting go of one clinging and then there's a grasping onto another. But it's different because when we are taking the time to notice this, to really be with our minds, to take time to really examine the truths that the Buddha was teaching us, then we have a possibility of that space, that pause in between our experiences. And of course, it's very normal just to keep failing, keep kind of same stories come up over and over again. But I think it was Thomas Edison who said that when he was asked about how he could have dealt with the enormous failure when he was trying to understand electricity and doing so with a light bulb. And I think he went through 10,000 trials. And the reporter who was talking to him said, how could you, it's unfathomable how one could have dealt with so much failure. And he just said, I didn't fail. I managed to harness electricity and created a light bulb. It took me 10,000 times. And that is the same attitude that we want to have with our own minds. We want to be okay with failing and the same story coming up and just think, oh, how can I not let go of this? How can this just keep coming up? I know I'm clinging to it, and yet I can't let go. And in fact, as most of you know, I think it was Ajahn Chah who actually said that we know that we're clinging, but 80% of the time that we know that we're clinging, we're not able to let go. The point is that even with that knowledge, it can be quite frustrating because you're like, I know this. I keep seeing this over and over again in my meditation. Why can't I focus? And I think it's more important to have that sense of what Ajahn Chah said and what Edison said as well. It's like, well, just, you know, it's not failure. It's just the path. We just keep intending to let go, and then it happens. We're just building a muscle. It doesn't, if you're starting to do push-ups every day, it's not advised, if you haven't been doing them, to start with 300. While I was on retreat, I was thinking of something, and it was quite a silly thing. It's just, in my own behavior, I can see that I move towards a hopeful outcome of something happening. And in this particular instance, I don't want to talk too specifically about what it was, but it was just some thing working out for the monastery. And I was asking Ajahn Janako about it. He would talk with me about it. And then I went into retreat, and he said, it's not going to work out. Oh. And it was such a silly thing. It was like, it really wasn't that important. So that's where my mind would go sometimes during the meditation. I'd proliferate about this thing. So, oh, and I'd come up with all these reasons why there shouldn't be these problems in the world. There shouldn't be this. It should always work out the way, or not always, but in this case. And then I would say, you know, at the end of the retreat, Ajahn Janako is going to probably tell you it worked out. And so, or the fact is, you have no idea what working out means anyway, because whatever the outcome is, we can't predict the future. We can't predict how it's going to be. So just let go, Chinda. And then I'd think about it again. And of course, after the retreat, then Ajahn Janako then told me, oh yeah, well actually, it seems like it's actually working out now. Oh, I knew that. I knew you were going to say that. And then 3 days later he said, oh actually, I think I'm wrong. Actually, it's not. It's probably not going to work out. It's humorous because it doesn't matter, you know. We're all going to die. You know, these things are just not that important. And I also recognize that I can say that to myself, and still the mind picks up this object and runs with it. And so I think it's important, as I was talking about with how we move towards solitude, how important that is. And even when we're in solitude, we're challenged. We just do need to try to intend towards what is the skillful thing for us, no matter how difficult it is, no matter how our tendency is to move in our sort of current circles of behavior, where we think, no, this is right, what I'm doing, how I'm doing it, my job, the particular people I'm around, how often I'm doing it, what I'm doing, and pull back from that many times, you know, several times a day, if if we can, to have these periods where we're able to look at our minds, not actually being around others, and have that quiet that we have. And of course, I'm not saying anything new. This is sort of beginner stuff. But that doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean that it comes with not making the same mistakes over and over. And also, I think I can remember over, you know, the last decade and a half of practicing in the monastery, just that sometimes I can get overconfident about it, saying, oh, this is great, especially during retreats, and just think, oh, then I'll be able to do this like this forever, and this is how I want to be, and it's going to be so much better, and then those behaviors can come right back. And it's very helpful to live in a community like this where people will remind you of that. My first day after retreat, in the afternoon, I ended up getting back on and working on one of these things. And Thang Kantiko walked in the late afternoon. He had seen me in there earlier, and he said, are you working on that list again? This is just one of the responsibilities I have. And I said, oh, yeah, well. And out came just whatever excuses need to be said, because that's what the mind wants to believe. Like, oh, no, there's a reason that I don't need to be alone right now. Or I was alone, actually, but I was doing something that I wouldn't call solitary. I would have to argue that with anybody who kind of says that computer work is good for the mind, I'd have to say most aspects, you'd probably definitely be wrong. So it's just those excuses. And the amazing fact was, of course, like, well, I had a great time on the retreat. It was really helpful. It was beneficial, unplugging. And what did I say to myself over and over? I'm not going to do that again. Every afternoon, going back, going to be alone, going to be quiet, spend this much time with formal practice, keep studying the suttas. And then our actions just continue again. So this is just something I think to continue to come back to continue to work on in your own practice. And this is, of course, an encouragement towards myself, and hope that some of it can benefit those who are listening. If there's anything that has been a benefit, then please take it with you. But anything else that is not, just feel free to leave it behind.